This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Last year we spoke about the fact that this was the first time that the view of democracy was taken up strongly. And it's strange, in fact, that Christian society that believes so strongly in democracy doesn't see Korach as the hero of the story, because he died for democracy. And with him, we hoped, would die democracy. But that's not the aspect of the machlokes that I want to discuss. This is one very simple little difficulty that I want to talk about briefly. One must imagine the situation. Am Yisrael has as their leader, as their Rov, and as their king, Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses. They couldn't hope for better. Not in any stage of society, not in any stage of history, could Am Yisrael ever have hoped for anybody better. Moshe Rabbeinu is the one who saw them through their difficulties. As a shaliach, as a messenger of God, he got them out of Egypt. Most miraculously, each time they got themselves into some situation of trouble or problem or difficulty, he got them out of it. He split the sea for them, he got the mon for them, he got the water for them, he got the slab, the meat that they wanted. He went up and he got the Torah. They heard the Ribbono Shel Olam talking to him. He's the only Novi, the only one of the prophets who's ever been able to communicate absolutely directly with God. There's no closer they could have come to being led by God himself than being led by Moshe Rabbeinu. And the strange thing is the aspect of his statement that David Miller said a few minutes ago. Vayikalu al Moshe ve'al Aaron, they gather together against Moshe and Aaron. Just imagine the picture. There's this Moshe and Aaron. And to imagine this picture properly, you should have seen the Michelangelo statue of Moshe. I don't know whether Moshe looked like that or he didn't look like that. But the concept of power, of personality, of the stature, that you see when looking at that statue, that he certainly had, and a lot more. Moshe Rabbeinu, he came down from the mountain with light streaming off his face, real light. His face wasn't shining figuratively, it was shining literally. And they come before these two men, Moshe and Aaron. What do they say to them? Rav Lachem, you've got enough now. Ki koma edat gulay mekadoshim. We're all equally holy, ubetocham Hashem, and amongst all of us is God. Umadua titnasu al kahal Hashem, and why do you lead the community of God? Give it over to someone else now. We've had enough of you. This isn't after very long. This is probably within days of leaving Mitzrayim. Not years, certainly. Maybe weeks. All of a sudden, Moshe and Aaron, the cream of society, the greatest of great, there's never been anybody like them. Enough now. Let's give someone else a chance. Rabbi Din is in town. So he's going to be speaking here tomorrow morning. Hopefully everybody will be here to hear him. People have gone all over to hear him. Let's say it wasn't Rabbi Dinner in town. Let's say the Chazon Ish was in town. We heard, let's say that tonight he was going to be speaking in Northcliffe. And he was going to start half an hour before Shabbos is over. I assure you there wouldn't be one person here. We would all schlep across to Northcliffe. As difficult as it is, and as long and far as it is, we would all schlep there to see him. Imagine if not the Chazon Ish in Northcliffe. We hear the Chofetz Chaim is coming to Northcliffe tonight. What's there to talk about? We would go and fetch our babies and take them there so that they should have the opportunity to see the Chofetz Chaim. Imagine it wasn't the Chofetz Chaim, imagine it was the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon is going to be in Northcliffe tonight. Can you imagine anybody going to a movie tonight? Not possible. Imagine it's Moshe Rabbeinu. Not the Vilna Gaon. Moshe Rabbeinu is going to be in Northcliffe tonight. Moshe Rabbeinu is going to be in Peter Maritzburg tonight. We would be there. Every one of us would be there. There'd be something wrong with us if we weren't. Opportunity to see Moshe Rabbeinu face to face. And if Moshe Rabbeinu was in Northcliffe tonight, and next week he was going to be in Oxford, and the week after he was going to be at the Kollel, and the week after he was going to be here, and then he would probably take on a position at one of the shuls, nobody would schlep. Maybe the first time they would schlep after he'd been here a couple of months. We would have fallen into the same trap. And this is a big chiddush. Because sure, one takes things for granted. But one hopes, or one would hope, that there are certain things which are above being taken for granted. Moshe Rabbeinu in our midst. Taken for granted. You have it in your shivas. You have an outstanding Rosh Hashiva, and somebody comes from the other end of the world to see this Rosh Hashiva. The Talmidim say, why? Where have you come from? He says, from New York. I'm from New York. So, what do you want here? Come to speak with the Rosh Hashiva. From New York? There aren't Rosh Hashivas in New York? Well, but not like your Rosh Hashiva. I don't know what he's talking about. The Rosh Hashiva can be the Chofetz Chaim, the Rosh Hashiva can be the Vilna Gaon, the Rosh Hashiva can be Moshe Rabbeinu. But we see here that even a Moshe Rabbeinu, after a couple of weeks, if there's certain elements missing in the Kahal, if there's certain elements missing in the community, why you? Why should you be the leaders of the community? What do you have that other people don't have? What is it? This is what we said, taken for granted. The enemy of vitality, the enemy of any kind of spiritual progress, is the tendency to take things for granted. Understand what that means. That means it's possible to have uniqueness such as there isn't anywhere in the whole world and not to notice it. Right? That means that Moshe Rabbeinu could theoretically be sitting right here and we wouldn't know. One of us sitting over here and we wouldn't know. Because you had that situation over there. You had Moshe Rabbeinu after having performed all his miracles. It wasn't Moshe Rabbeinu unknown before anyone discovered him or before anyone had heard about him. It was Moshe Rabbeinu after everything, sitting there with the Am Yisrael. And they couldn't distinguish the difference between him and anybody else. He was just as ordinary as anybody else. How is it possible? It's that enemy of progress taking things for granted. What is it that causes one to take something for granted? There are two things, really. The first thing is being spoiled. Having something before you need it is the first thing to guarantee that you'll take something for granted. Before we go into analyzing that a little bit, we can't understand this. To us, this is incredible. To think that it were possible that Moshe Rabbeinu would be with us for a few months, and after a few months we would already be saying, why him? What's he different from anyone else? That's something that we find absolutely incredible, and we are sure, I was sure when I learnt this, that it wouldn't happen to me. That if Moshe Rabbeinu, or for that matter the Chazon Ish, or the Chofetz Chaim, or any other Gadol b'Yisrael, was sitting right among us, there's no way he would be taken for granted. And yet you think a little bit, and one does take things for granted. Imagine you're very sensitive to color and to beauty, and you're walking, I take you for a walk in the fields, and I take you to a most beautiful field of flowers. Millions of different flowers of different colors and different shapes, and you just see this huge expanse of color and beauty. And you look at this and you get totally absorbed in it, and eventually you get so excited that you say, you would like to consume that. It's not good enough seeing the color. You know, if one gets really excited about something, you want to get as close as you possibly can to it. And it comes to a point where you're not satisfied by just seeing the color. You want to relate more directly to the color, and you say, if only you could eat it. And I said, it's not food. It's to be seen. Flowers can't be eaten, even if you cook them, even if you boil them. They won't taste like anything you want to eat. Imagine you getting disappointed. Only you could to taste what it's like. A thing that looks like this must taste incredible. It must smell incredible. Smell you can. And you smell it and you really want to eat it now. Imagine I take a wand out of my pocket and I go like this. I give you a bottle. And I say, that's the flowers. They're all still there. The flowers are untouched. Now you can taste the flowers. You taste the flowers and it's tough at the flowers. You would never take such a thing for granted. That's what a bee does. That's what honey is. Gives you the sweetness and the beauty of the flowers, it translates it from visual to taste. It's magic. We don't know how it's done. It's incredible. And what do we think? Put the honey on your bread and eat it. Flowers, we don't forget that it comes from flowers. Who thinks that honey comes from flowers? What does honey got to do with flowers altogether? And so it is with everything. Milk from grass. Think of it. Milk from grass. Protein, cheese. All the different kinds of cheeses with all their different flavors. You're eating grass. Look at the chesed of the Ribbono Shel Olam. Look at the kindness of the Ribbono Shel Olam. He doesn't want us to be bored with eating grass. So he makes the cow get bored with eating grass, and he makes the cow, by some magical process, give us the, he makes the cow translate that grass into hundreds of different types of tastes. There's milk, and there's cream, and there's butter, and there's this kind of cheese, and that kind of cheese, and then what you can only do with the cheeses, and with the milks, and with the butters, and with the creams. Grass you're eating. Grass in a different form. One would think that that couldn't be taken for granted. We do. And if we're capable of taking honey for granted, and we're capable of taking milk for granted, let me assure you, we're capable of taking Moshe Rabbeinu for granted. There's nothing more wonderful about Moshe Rabbeinu than there is about honey or milk. There's nothing more wonderful about the Chazon Ish or the Vilna Gaon than there is about honey and milk. There's nothing more ingenious. Nothing the Vilna Gaon said or nothing Moshe Rabbeinu said is any more ingenious than the process of changing these various different minerals and foods into other forms. What causes this taking for granted? Two things, as we were saying. The first thing is getting it before you need it. The reason that you wouldn't imagine that you could take, when I gave you the illustration of seeing the flower field, the reason you couldn't imagine yourself taking it for granted is because there's such a need to taste that the man who's impressed with this color and who's really taken in with the color and the smell is so overwhelmed with a need to consume it and so aware of the impossibility of being able to consume it that when someone waves a wand and bridges the impossible with the possible, there's no way that's going to be taken for granted. But that's because he suffered without it first. If you're in a desert and you're thirsty, you've got to go a couple of days before you find a little tiny container of water, you're not going to take that water for granted. When you get back to the city, you'll be taking it for granted again. But as long as you got your fulfillment after your need and not before your need, you don't take it for granted. The trouble is, we get our fulfillment before we need it. That's the essence of being spoiled. Helping a child out before the child needs your help, that's spoiling a child. Us being helped out before we need it, that's spoiling us. And the essence of Am Yisrael at this particular stage of their lives, at this particular stage of their existence, as we discussed last week, was in fact the fact that they were spoiled, the fact that they were receivers, the fact that they had were given things before they really needed. The moment they were a little bit thirsty, there was the water. The moment they were a little bit hungry, there was the moon. They didn't have to battle for anything. They didn't have to struggle for anything. And the style of life that we find ourselves in today is identical to the style of lives that they had then between Egypt and coming to Eretz Israel. That's why this part of the Torah is so very relevant to us. Need water? Turn on a tap. You need a light? Switch on the light. You need a house? Go to the building society for a loan. There's nothing we have to struggle for. It's all there. A little bit more, a little bit less, but there's nothing essential. There's nothing important that we need that we haven't got. There's no way that one can't take things for granted that way. In fact, it's imperative when one takes things for granted. Is it? Is it possible that the Ribbono Shel Olam would put us into a situation where we have to take things for granted? He did it to them and he's done it to us. What does he expect of us? How does he expect us to get excited with his creations? How does he expect us to get excited about nature and the various things about us? He's put us into a situation of satisfying our needs before we need them. So we must say that it's still possible to experience this excitement with something new. It's not taken for granted, because after all, that's what not taken for granted is. The excitement of novelty. Anything which is not the excitement of novelty is taken for granted. Something new, something that you've needed. It can be done in the following way. Imagine at the table, instead of bringing water in an ordinary old jug, I brought water in a sealed bottle with a wax seal around the top, with a very fancy print on it, a label printed very stylishly, and the bottle is an expensive bottle, the label is an expensive label, and I poured it out in little crystal cut glasses this big. So test some of this and tell me what you think of it. The same water, but I assure you, you would taste things in the water that you didn't normally taste. You would discover it's water, it wouldn't fool you for long. But in those first moments, while you were deciding what it is, you would taste things that you never tasted before in water. What did it? The bottle put things in the water that weren't there? Likewise, if you take a very expensive wine and bring it to the table in a cheap wine bottle, you would have to be pretty much of a connoisseur to immediately notice that it's rubbish and have the courage to say that it's rubbish. Very few people would take that chance. Not because they're fooled by the label and they think that it's expensive wine, so it must be good. But they will give such chashivas, they will give such importance and dedication to those moments of tasting it, because they taste it with the assumption it's special. And it might take them a few moments before they decide it isn't. But during those moments of tasting, they put in such effort and such energy to notice the flavor and the particular aspects of it and so on and so forth, that they'll notice taste in that wine that they would never notice if you brought it in a cheap thing. The same as you don't notice the water until it's brought in something special and it's presented to you in a special way. And so it's possible to get excited about something ordinary, provided it's not presented to you in an ordinary way. It has to be presented in a very special way. And we've discussed this once before, the role of presentation, but we've discussed it usually in terms of how you present things to other people. What we haven't talked about much is the need to present them carefully to yourself. One has the same in every aspect of life. We'll come to one of the aspects in a moment. In a shiur, in a tape that, of a shiur that my father gave a couple of years ago, which David Platsky lent me, he says, on a similar sort of problem, that tefillah, prayer, has the ability to achieve on both levels. Has the ability to solve the problem, both in the light of need and in the light of presentation. How come? You stand in the davening tonight and you say Rafa'ina. What do you mean? God, heal us from our illness. Who's ill? So maybe one of us will know somebody who's ill. But what do you really mean when you stand there and you say Rafa'ina? Apart from many other aspects of meaning, the one thing it enables you to do is to spend half a moment thinking what it would be like to have to ask God to heal you, even if the tefillah achieves nothing else for you. Even if when you stand there and you say, Ribbono Shelam, heal me, make me better, all my pains and aches and everything, even if all you achieve is a short moment of making believe that you're not healthy. And when you say Atachanen Ladam Dat, you praise God for giving knowledge and you ask God to give you knowledge. If during those moments all you achieve is the feeling of what it would be like to really be completely imbecilic and need to pray to God day by day to give you the knowledge just to get on with an ordinary day's work, even if that's all it gives you, it enables you to relate to the day-to-day things in a way that you have felt a need for it before you got it. That's the essentialness of starting your day with davening. So that you can, as things come your way during the day, they're not things that are coming before you've needed them. There was a little moment early this morning when you felt the need for it, and you understood how terrible it could be to go through your day without it. Now you get it, that won't be taken for granted. That's the one thing that tefillah does. The other thing that tefillah does is the following. This is the more important in a sense. We talked about presentation. If you pour out some whiskey and I don't see the bottle and I say, what whiskey is this? You say, Shivers Regal. What do I do, sir? Shivers Regal. And already the approach is different. And the effort I'll put into enjoying it will be that much more. Why? Shivers Regal, after all. They know how to make whiskey. The same with wine. Tell me it's such and such a wine from such and such a vintage. That was the wine. That's the real thing. I'll get into a car and I'll be driving along. It's a very smooth car. What kind of car is it? It's a Rolls Royce. It's Royce. It's a different thing. You look around differently. You notice things that you didn't notice. You look at every little thing, the light fitting and the wood paneling and all the things which you wouldn't even notice normally because, you know, they're cheap. They're nothing special. Rolls Royce, all of a sudden you start looking. It becomes important. What more do you need when I get this roll? I say, where does it come from? I say, Kofit. That's not the answer. How should I feel? I say, where does this role come from? I say, the Ribbono Shel. How can't I get excited if I understand who the Ribbono Shel is? Get excited because of Mr. Rolls Royce. You get excited because of Mr. Rothschild's wine. and you get excited because of Mr. Shiva's Regal's whiskey. But what the Ribbono Shel Olam makes, so he knows how to make challah, he knows how to make bread. He doesn't bread. Whiskey, it's not Shiva's Regal, what is it? It's only the Ribbono Shel Olam's after all. It shows a completely cockeyed sense of perspective. One isn't able to trace things far back enough and realize the importance of them and the beauty of them in the terms of the master who made them. There isn't anything which hasn't been made by a master. And so one's able, through a brocha on the one hand, or through tefillah, through davening on the other hand, A, to create a need before something is given to you, and B, one's able to appreciate the presentation, one's able to establish a chashivas, to establish a sense of importance to something which would otherwise appear ordinary. But with us it doesn't work. It doesn't work because we don't know who the Ribbono Shel Olam is. Simple as that. Call the bushman and give him some drink and say, this is Shiva's Regal. What's he going to do? Taste it any better? Call an African and tell him, take him into a Midi Miner and tell him it's a Rolls Royce and say, yes, boss. It doesn't mean anything to him. It's unimportant. And we find ourselves in that situation. Who made this? The Ribbono Shel Olam. Oh, very nice. Who's the Ribbono Shel Olam? We don't know him. We have no relationship to him. We have no feeling of importance. It doesn't make the bread any more important. That's our problem. That's why I said what my father said is only partly right. It's right in theory, but it's not right in practice. Because we are the people who need tefillah in order to create the sense of importance and the sense of urgency, and we are the people that can't possibly help because it doesn't mean anything. And comes the question, this relates back to last week's shiur. How does one establish a relationship with him? What is the problem with our relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam, you know? We talked about taking Rabbi Dinah for granted. And we talked about taking the Chazon Ish for granted. And we talked about taking the Chofetz Chaim for granted. It's getting more and more difficult as we go along, but all very possible. We talked about taking the Vilna Gaon for granted. We talked about taking Moshe Rabbeinu for granted, the Rambam for granted, whoever you want to. It's all very possible. And we proved that it's possible because we can take honey and milk for granted. Now what would happen when we look back at this? Happens every time we read this part of the parasha and the Am Yisrael start complaining about food and water and this and that. We say, my goodness, these people have been brought out with the 10 plagues. They came to the sea and the sea was split for them. They saw Matan Torah. They've seen all the miracles it's possible for any human being to see. What are they worried? God's going to leave them now? What's all the complaining about? If we had been in such a situation where we'd seen all that, would we be such ordinary people today? If we do the things we do, we would be completely different people on a completely different level. So what were they doing? They were taking God for granted. And we can't understand that. How is it possible to take God for granted? We can take God for granted because we never see Him. But they, who saw Him daily, taking God for granted. If we claim that, we're either liars, or it must be liars. Because we say it three times a day. We say, Ribbono Shel Olam, we cannot stop thanking you. Morning and afternoon and evening, we don't stop thanking you for a moment. Why? Al chayenu hamesurim biyodecha. Firstly, we appreciate that our lives are in your hand and at any moment you can take it away. That's what Mark spoke about last Shabbos. We appreciate the urgency of it. We appreciate the gratitude and the feeling of fullness that we have in the fact that you've let us live another moment. We're not talking in days now, we're talking in moments. Each moment, I thank you, Ribbono Shel Olam, because you've let me live another moment. And our souls are in your hands. And your miracles that we see every day. We say it. Miracles, we see miracles every day. I mean, you say this three times a day. If you believe it, and what's your claim against Am Yisrael? They saw miracles, you saw miracles. What miracles did they see? Splitting the sea? What's that compared to making honey? What's that compared to milk? Nothing. Don't forget, they didn't see you making milk and honey and all that kind of thing. They were in the desert. The only miracles they saw were those dramatic looking miracles. But the real incredible miracles that we see every day, they didn't see that much of. V'amiflotecha, and your wonders, v'tovotecha, your goodnesses, shebechol eid, every moment, erev, avokhi, v'tzorayim, evening, morning and afternoon. Those are the things we're aware of all the time. Where were you aware of it? We take for granted. So if it's possible to take the Ribbono Shel Olam for granted, it's possible to take anything for granted. Only trouble is, when you're taking the Ribbono Shel Olam for granted, you can't get out of the vicious circle. Because how did we say, in order to not to take Kofi's Chalef for granted, one has to understand that it's God who made it. But if you're taking God for granted, it doesn't help you. Shiv is regal, you don't take for granted because it cost a lot of money when you bought it. But the Kofi's Chalef didn't take, so it cost so much money. So God isn't that important because the price tag isn't that high. If you had to pay a lot for God's Chalef, you know, you could buy two brands, the devils and gods, and you had to pay a lot for gods, we would appreciate God. But it doesn't work like that, because everything is God's, and it's cheap. You don't have to buy a Rolls Royce, you can buy a million, it's also God's. When we've lost that feeling of chashivas, that feeling of importance for God himself, then there's no way out of it. So it has to work out, how do you recapture the feeling of chashivas for God himself? We've got to use the same two mechanisms. To create a need is impossible. A parent will never take a child for granted. A child will always take a parent for granted. A parent must never expect great things in return for what he does from his children, because his children by nature will take him for granted. Why? Because from the first day the child was born, he had a parent. It wasn't so with the parents. In other words, the parents had a need before they were given the children. The children never had a need for a parent. On the contrary, they were given a parent long before they knew they had a need. We are the children of the Ribbono Shel Olam, and there's no way we'll understand what it is to need God. We're spoiled. We were given him from the moment we were born. We've had a relationship with him all the time. He's around. He's around when you're in trouble, you can call him. Everybody knows that. And when anybody gets into trouble, they do call him. So to create a need, artificial or genuine, for the Ribbono Shel Olam, that's not going to work. So we only have one alternative left. That's to wrap him up in good paper. That's what one has to do. The question, and this really is the question we were left with to a degree at the end of last week's year. How does one establish a love relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam? To establish a love relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam has got to be important. It's got to be something worthwhile establishing a love relationship with it. It's worthwhile, you like it. But the first thing is to appreciate the worthwhileness of it. And here you have to see that although intellectually we might not like to admit that this is the way we function, in truth it is. If the liquid is brought in a fancy looking bottle, we taste all sorts of wonderful things and we relate to it with great care and respect. We've seen people handling expensive wine. The way we handle the Sefer Torah looks disgusting compared to the way they handle a bottle of wine. Care, temperatures, holding it, what angle you hold it, how you pour it out, how you make it stand up again. Sefer Torah, pick it up, walk with it, take it, put it in, take it, nothing. They've created a certain chashivas around the wine, which enables you to taste things which are there but which you wouldn't taste if there wasn't that drama and that ritual that went with the wine tasting. And we have ignored to create such rituals, or such an extent of rituals when it comes to the Sefer Torah. One has to understand that in order to develop a feeling of chashivas with the Ribbono Shel Olam, the only method of doing it is just that. You come to davening. Don't come in the same clothes you worked in. Change when you want to do it. If you really want to do it, if you're serious about doing it, I'm not saying everybody has to do this. It's a question of whether you want to establish such a relationship with God or not. But if you do, you won't do it sort of coming from the office, davening the way you came from the office. That's not chashivas. The queen invited you to a banquet, that's not the way you would go. If you didn't have a dinner suit, you would hire one or buy one. It's the queen after all. But the Ribbono Shel Olam's cheap. It doesn't require that you hire special clothes to go and see him. Esav knew how to do it. That same old wicked Esav never used to go and visit his parents in his regular clothes. He used to change every time he saw his father, because he wanted to retain that special, he never wanted to take his father for granted. He wanted to retain that special relationship that he had, no matter what. If his father would call him, just a moment, change into his Shabbos clothes, go and see his father. He would never go and see him in any other way. And there's no way we're going to establish a relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam other than by doing just that. By going out of one's way to create a ritual around anything to do with God, which is at least equivalent to the ritual they put around the queen as far as anything concerned with her is concerned. If it means a question of the davening, it's a question of not walking in late to the davening. You wouldn't walk in late to the queen. If you got a message that the queen was expecting to see you at 4 o'clock in the morning, never mind 6 o'clock in the morning, you wouldn't walk in at 3 minutes past 4. You'd be standing outside Buckingham Palace at half past 3. You'd be ready to be there the moment you're called in. Not just that that's a show of respect to the Ribbono Shel Olam, but that's the only way. It's by these tricks that one's able to create an atmosphere where tattva becomes important, where you start feeling it's God after all. How can you expect to feel that it's God? How can you expect to feel that if it is the Ribbono Shel Olam, if you relate to Him as if you're just anybody else? And so it is with everything we do. That's why we wash before we daven.
Mm-hmm.
Wash your hands. Before you eat, wash your hands. Say a bracha before you eat. Whatever it is. You're going to light candles on Friday night. Not just lighting candles. It's something you're doing for the Ribbono Shel Olam. It has to be done in a very special way. Otherwise, there's no way you're going to relate to God through the mitzvah. Mitzvah is a ritual and it has nothing to do with God. How important is this? The Gemara says the following. It's a strange Gemara. Amar Rav Yehuda. Amar Rav. Said Rav Yehuda in the name of Rav. Kol ha-mit-atzel be-hespeidol shel chacham ra'u le-kovro b'chayav. Anyone who shows a bit of laziness in giving a hesped, a eulogy, for a chacham, for a wise man, deserves to be buried alive. Why is that? Is that the worst thing? Buried alive is quite something. Not a pleasant way to die. Why is that exactly chosen? It doesn't say a person who doesn't eulogize. No, you do eulogize. Not a person who doesn't mourn or who's lazy in his mourning for a chacham. No. Anybody who's lazy in eulogizing. Now, hesped is the thing you do straight after the person dies. The person dies on the same day there's a funeral, and at the funeral you give a hesped. If a man gives a hesped in a lazy way, that means he lets a bit of time go before he really starts giving a hesped, before he starts eulogizing, then he's learned to appreciate the chacham, he's learned to appreciate the wise man through loss. As the loss has dawned on him, he suddenly realizes, oh, what we've lost, just look at it. It's a Moshe Rabbeinu after all, it's a Chazanish, it's a Chofetz Chaim, look at him, how are we going to manage now? The man who eulogizes the moment he dies, that's not a man who's learnt out of loss. That's a man who appreciated all the time, and the moment the man was taken away, he doesn't know what to do with himself, and he eulogizes, he gives a hesped, oh, what's going to happen now? He didn't need the loss to shake him. Because the moment the loss came, he was there. If there's a mitatzel, if there's a person who in any way expresses the slightest delay in crying and eulogizing the loss of a chacham, that person deserves to be buried alive. Why? It's taken for granted. And taking for granted is death. Why do we wait for a person to die before you bury him? Because as long as he's living, he has a chance to progress. It would be wrong to bury him while he's still living. That's the only reason, really. He's still a living person, he's still a man who can progress. The moment he dies, he can't continue to progress, so you bury him. A man who's lost the ability of hitchadshus, a man who's lost the ability to see new things and the objects around him, he's dead. There's no way he can progress. If every day is the same as the day before, what point is there in living? So you don't have to wait for him to die. What's there to wait for? You can allegorically bury him alive as well. There's no mitzvah in keeping him going. The art of finding something new in the relationship between a subject and an object is the art of living. Without that, there's nothing. And the only way it can be done on a day-to-day level is by chashivas. The thing has to be important. You've got to create an aura of atmosphere, an aura of importance, and an atmosphere of dedication around something that you want to find something new. Unless it's really new. If it's really new, then you can just relate to it on the basis of it being new. But then the moment it's no longer new, you have to create a special order. Look, for example, at the difference between Shabbos and Yom Kippur. Comes Yom Kippur, once a year, it's dramatic. The way people are dressed in white, the music of the shul is dramatic, the whole thing is dramatized, everybody's in shul. Shuls are packed. Comes a Shabbos, which is much more important than a Yom Kippur, the shuls are empty. What's the logic? Human beings don't relate with logic. They relate with drama. Shabbos comes once a week. It's too frequent. And to retain a kovod, to retain a sense of love and importance for something that comes once a week, you have to treat it in a very special way. You don't wear on Shabbos what you wear the rest of the day, the rest of the week. You don't talk on Shabbos the way you talk the rest of the week. You don't do on Shabbos what you do the rest of the week. as Friday starts drawing to a close, you start building up the excitement, things start getting ready, you do all sorts of strange things getting into it, all of a sudden Shabbos comes and there's an attitude to it and a way of looking at it, you come home, the table's set, not like it's normally set, your best stuff is out, your best cutlery, your best crockery, your best glasses, you see it, something important. That way you can relate to Shabbos. But if you didn't do that, don't think you could enjoy Shabbos. Don't think you would have any kind of relationship to it at all. What happened to Korach? Buried alive. That was the end of Korach. Because of this Gemara. His Aveira was the taking of Moshe for granted. Not creating sufficient aura around Moshe Rabbeinu to be able to pick out the uniqueness of Moshe Rabbeinu. And for that dryness and for that stagnancy, there's no reason to carry on living. There's no reason even to wait until you die. The mouth of the earth just opens up and swallows him. It's just, he has no part to play. Even a funeral would be a waste of time. Really, that's the concept of being buried alive the way Korach was. I was trying to wake up. What is it? What kind of a punishment is it? It's saving society the bother of burying him. He could have been burnt in a fire. He could have been killed with a plague. Anything could have happened. He's buried. The Rebbe Mishnah buries him alive. We don't have to put up a tombstone for him. We don't have to take him to the cemetery. We don't have to watch him. We don't have to give his body a tara. All the effort and energy that goes into burying a dead person, we're spared. There's no point in it. There's no point in waiting for him to die. There's no point in giving him these last rites, if you want to call it that. The reason, because of stagnancy, the inability to find uniqueness where uniqueness really lies. I'm not asking to find uniqueness where there's none. To find uniqueness where uniqueness really lies, that's an art which one has to develop and retain.